From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. If you're interested in the differences between how, quote, normal people and people with developmental disorders are wired, I think you'll be interested in what Dr. Fred Volkmar has to say. You'll be especially interested if you or anyone you know has been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome. People with Asperger's are typically very verbal, but have difficulty making conversation. They're often physically awkward and very obsessive about their favorite subject. Dr. Volkmar is a professor at the Yale University Child Study Center and heads the university's autism research. We'll also hear from Michael John Carley, an adult who was diagnosed with Asperger's 4 years ago after his son was diagnosed. Now Carley heads an Asperger's education and support group. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The American general in charge of U.S.-run detention centers in Iraq has formally apologized to the people of Iraq for the abuse of prisoners by U.S. troops. American military police are accused of abusing and humiliating some Iraqi inmates at a prison west of Baghdad. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports.
At Abu Ghraib, Major General Jeffrey Miller apologized to Iraqis for what he called the appalling and embarrassing acts of a few soldiers. And General Miller said the Army has re-examined the list of, quote, approved interrogation techniques and would now halt some practices in Iraq.
For example, we will no longer in any circumstances hood any of the detainees. We will use no stress positions in any of our interrogations. And we will not use sleep deprivation in any of our interrogations.
The U.S. military took some Western and Arab journalists Wednesday on a tightly controlled tour of Abu Ghraib. At a sprawling outdoor tent city detention camp, prisoners shouted at reporters. One yelled, "We want our dignity, our rights, our freedom." Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Baghdad.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is scheduled to testify before the Senate Armed Services Committee on Friday about the prisoner mistreatment scandal. President Bush tried to defuse widespread Arab anger today about the abuse by giving interviews to two Arabic language television channels. He told the interviewers that the abuses were abhorrent and promised that the guilty parties would be brought to justice. Three American soldiers were killed today in fighting in southern Iraq. U.S. troops launched an assault on militiamen loyal to the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Military officials say at least 15 Iraqis were killed in raids in several Shiite cities. Martha Stewart will not be getting a new trial. A federal judge in Manhattan denied the request exactly 2 months after Stewart and her broker, Peter Bakanovic, were convicted of lying to investigators about the sale of M-Clone stock. Alicia Zuckerman reports from member station WNYC.
Stewart claimed she did not get a fair trial because one of the jurors lied about his arrest record on a pretrial questionnaire. Chappelle Hartridge did not disclose that he had been arrested in a domestic dispute. Stewart's lawyer argued that if he had known about the arrest, he would have struck Hartridge from the jury during jury selection. The judge also rejected arguments that comments made by Hartridge after the trial showed a bias against Stewart. He called the verdict a victory for the little guy. Stewart and Bakanovic are scheduled to be sentenced on June 17th. The decision is the second victory this week for Manhattan federal prosecutors. Investment banker Frank Quattrone was convicted of obstruction of justice charges on Monday. For NPR News, I'm Alicia Zuckerman in New York.
In stocks, the Dow lost 6 to close at 10,311. The Nasdaq lost again 6 to 1957. This is NPR News. Republican leaders in Congress say the Bush administration will ask Congress to approve another $25 billion for U.S. operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. The White House had earlier planned not to ask for additional funding until after the November election. The administration is currently drawing from an $87.5 billion funding package that was approved last fall. The Brazilian government says it plans to send the army into Rio de Janeiro to help the local police force in its war against drug gangs. NPR's Martin Costi reports from Rio.
The military is responding to a plea for help from the governor of the state of Rio, whose police force has been stretched by a recent upsurge in the deadly turf battles between rival drug gangs. Most of the violence has been confined to the slums, known as favelas, but Rio's wealthier population got a scare last month when two drug lords battled each other for control of a slum close to the chic neighborhood of Ipanema. Since then, the state government has been under intense political pressure to do more to control the drug gangs, whose arsenals include grenades and even anti-tank rockets. Human rights groups here worry that the soldiers lack the policing skills to operate in Rio's maze-like slums, but the military says it will select paratroopers and commandos who are trained for urban combat. Martin Costi, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
The Walt Disney Company is refusing to distribute a new documentary by Michael Moore. The film, called Fahrenheit 9/11, is critical of the Bush administration's handling of the September 11th attacks. Moore told NPR that he plans to seek distribution for the film himself. Moore won an Academy Award in 2002 for his documentary Bowling for Columbine. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Argosy Foundation Contemporary Music Fund, supporting the creation, performance, and recording of new music.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you're interested in how the brain affects personality and behavior, and the differences between how, quote, normal people and people with developmental disorders are wired, I think you'll want to hear what my guest, Dr. Fred Volkmar, has to say. But you'll be especially interested if you or anyone you know has been diagnosed with Asperger syndrome. Dr. Volkmar is the primary author of the medical definition in the DSM-IV, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association. He's a professor at the Yale University Child Study Center and directs autism research at Yale. He's also the co-author of the book Healthcare for Children on the Autism Spectrum. Whether Asperger's is a form of autism is still being debated. Dr. Volkmar says that children with Asperger's typically talk before they walk. Parents are reassured by how bright they are, but their motor skills develop late. Problems often become more apparent in preschool when these verbal children have trouble communicating with others. I asked Dr. Volkmar if people with Asperger syndrome are usually high-functioning and if they typically have a special talent or area of knowledge.
People with Asperger syndrome in general do not have mental retardation. That's one of the differences from autism. In autism, probably about 65-70% of people overall function in the intellectually deficient or the mentally retarded range. In Asperger's syndrome, it's very rare for that to happen. In terms of special interest in Asperger's, the man who first talked about Asperger's syndrome was a man named Hans Asperger. He made the point that all the children he described had very unusual special interests. The thing that was unusual about the special interest was it was all-consuming. The child would have known all the trains into and out of Vienna, the 6:15 stopping at Leipzig and Salzburg. Or the child would, for example, have known all about American gangsters. I've seen all kinds of things that kids are interested in. That's one of the very typical defining features of Asperger's syndrome.
Now, do you consider Asperger's syndrome to be a form of autism? My understanding is that this is pretty controversial.
There's a lot of discussion right now about the best way to think about this. Essentially, the world, unfortunately, turns into, in a simple-minded way, the world can be divided into lumpers and splitters. The lumpers want to see everything together. And there's a certain point to that in the sense of, certainly in terms of the shared social difficulties, children with Asperger's syndrome have some of the same needs that children with autism do. On the other hand, I would argue, in this case with the splitters, that the difference in Asperger's is that the much better verbal skills gives us another route to try to help the child deal with their difficulties. It's rather different than what we would think of as autism.
I know three families who have children that have been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome. One of the reasons why I'm interested in this is that some of the things that we just take for granted as being part of the human condition, a desire to communicate with people, empathy, reading people's faces and just kind of understanding the emotion that is being conveyed, are not typically part of the behavior pattern for people who do have Asperger syndrome. So, you know, it's like they are kind of outside of what we consider to be, quote, normal, and yet function pretty well. And it really kind of makes you think so much about what's different. What are the differences, like biochemically or neurologically, that that result in this? So let's start with the idea that a lot of people with Asperger's syndrome seem to be lacking in what we would describe empathy, and aren't interested in talking for pleasure, in communicating for pleasure. Could you describe an example of that?
Well, it's interesting that one of the problems is kids with Asperger's like to talk, but it's a very one-sided talk. So it's kind of a machine gun. You feel almost assaulted sometimes that you hear more and more and more about whatever the child's interest is. But then you don't have a chance to take a turn. So that there's this funny sense of not connecting with the child. It can come across, especially initially, as somewhat humorous. When I go around and give conferences, and I have a few videotapes of children, adolescents, and adults with Asperger's, I warn the audience ahead of time that they may laugh, and that the parents in the audience may feel upset that people are laughing, and that both groups are right. That the thing that's very odd is that you have this sense of, it's almost like a Monty Python skit sometimes, that people talking past each other. And it's not necessarily meant to be funny, but to most of us just watching it, at least at the beginning, it seems kind of humorous because you think it's a put-on. The kinds of things that kids come up with, for example, I had a child not very long ago, I was asking him, a child will call Jimmy. I said, Jimmy, tell me, what would you like to be doing in 50 years? And he looked at me, he said, you know, I don't know, but you're going to be dead.
That's a kind of inappropriate thing to say, isn't
right,
it?
Right, right. So, you know, you see all kinds of things of that kind, and it's always surprising. I had one boy who studied stars and planets. He knew all about the constellations. He was really, really into astronomy. And he said to me one day, Dr. Volkmar, I've only got one question that I've never been able to find the answer to. And I said, yeah, what's that? He said, you know, I've learned all about the stars and the planets and the names and the constellations. How did the scientists ever discover the names for the stars and planets? He had no idea that this was a human construction, that, you know, what we see as the Big Dipper, other people saw as the Great Bear, other people saw as something else, that there's no sense of that very interesting kind of awareness of the human condition.
Hmm. Is there any scientific explanation of what creates this kind of communicative difference? Is there something going on in the brain? Is it some kind of like biochemical thing?
Actually, there's some data that would very strongly suggest a big role for genetic factors. In our research, when we take a very strict definition of Asperger's and look among family members, about one-third of the time, we find another family member with a very significant social disability, often males. Interestingly, Asperger's is more likely in boys than in girls. It's interesting that genetics may even be stronger than autism, and autism is one of the most strongly genetic disorders. We also know a little bit about the way the brain works in Asperger's. People are developing very interesting techniques for understanding differences in terms of how the brain is wired. So, for example, one of the things we've been interested in is looking at a part of the brain called the fusiform gyrus, which is a part of the brain that most of us, I'll say, activate, turn on. It basically is the part of the brain that when we look at faces, it switches on. And it's interesting that children, high-functioning kids with autism and Asperger's, when you show them faces, that part of the brain does not turn on. The part of the brain that does turn on is the part of the brain that the rest of us use for looking at objects.
So what does that tell you? How do you interpret it?
Well, I think it's, among other things, it's telling us that there's a whole different brain system than the rest of us are using, that the wiring is fundamentally very different. I'm not saying better or worse, but just very different, that faces don't have the specialness. And in fact, we would argue that one of the problems for children with Asperger's, and to some extent even for autism, is that that lack of a connection to other people, that lack of the interest in the specialness of the other person, which is the fundamental problem, and indeed may reflect something about how the person's brain is put together.
You know, a lot of us might feel sorry for somebody with Asperger's syndrome who is missing this connection to other people and the joy that you can have in connecting through touch or conversation with another person. But do you think the people you know and the children you know with Asperger's syndrome feel that they're missing anything?
I would say one of the things that's often very poignant, especially about adolescents with Asperger's and young adults, is a desire for human connection, a desire for relationships, a desire for a girlfriend, a desire for some element of human contact and relationship. I think one of the things that's in some ways is rather different than even higher functioning autism. One of the things, sadly, is that often in adolescence, kids with Asperger's become depressed, I think partly as a result of that.
Hmm. If a person, say, doesn't relate through conversation well and has that kind of very one-sided, almost obsessive form of conversing. Does it help to work with them on that, to kind of teach them the structure of conversation, the give and take of conversation?
Absolutely, and there are many different things you can do. Speech pathologists, psychologists, psychiatrists, there are a lot of different folks who can really teach very explicit things about having a conversation. For example, having the child periodically say something like, am I talking too much, or is this more than you want to know? That gives them a chance to get some feedback, which otherwise they never would get because they don't pay any attention. And it structures things. It seems a little odd and stilted, and it is a little odd and stilted, but it gets them feedback.
My guest is Dr. Fred Volkmar, a professor at the Yale Child Study Center and an expert on autism and Asperger syndrome. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Fred Volkmar is my guest. He's a child psychiatrist at the Yale Child Study Center. He's an expert on Asperger syndrome and co-author with his wife of the book Healthcare for Children on the Autism Spectrum. Now, a lot of children with Asperger's tend to have a lower threshold for sensory input, you know, like loud sounds are more upsetting than they would be to the average person. They might be pickier about foods. I guess other things along those lines. Can you talk about that a little bit and how it connects?
Sure. You commonly see children with Asperger's who have unusual sensory experiences. They can't stand certain kinds of cloth, for example, or clothing. They'll only eat certain kinds of food. I've seen children who would only eat white food. I've seen children who would only eat French fries from a particular fast food restaurant. These are very common. They're a source of great concern to parents, and it can be a very big problem in terms of schools. I would say in terms of our understanding of them, interestingly enough, I would tend to lay the blame on the social difficulties in the sense that I suspect that a lot of us very early in life learn from our parents and because we're so socially connected to them that we basically gate out a lot of sensory experiences that we learn just are irrelevant. The problem for people with Asperger's, and this is also true in autism, is that those same things that the rest of us could gate out, they can't help but focus on. They can't gate it out. It's impossible for them to ignore it.
Is Asperger's syndrome often confused with obsessive compulsive disorder or depression or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder? Because some of the symptoms are the same.
A very good point. And in fact, one of the things that was fascinating when we first got into the, my colleagues and I started working on Asperger's, we had an inquiry from the Learning Disabilities Association of America if we could sent them some information on it, and they published a little article. And very promptly, we had 600 parents from around the country who wrote to us. This was in very early days of Asperger's, to say they had a child they thought probably had Asperger's. And many children were misdiagnosed, and many children still indeed are. Interestingly enough, I would say in school-aged children, the kinds of things that often are identified as problems are attentional difficulties. The school, for example, will see a boy who's very verbal. They also see him as being kind of hyperactive. He talks back to the teacher. They may think of him as being a bad boy. They may think of him as having attentional problems. As time goes on, especially by the time the children get into adolescence, the depression often becomes more striking. But in fact, the interesting thing is the Asperger's is there throughout, and it's not so clear to me how central these other things are, like the attentional problems and the depression. I don't think they're the core aspect of Asperger's itself.
Do you think that Asperger's syndrome is misdiagnosed a lot and that therefore parents or teachers often do the wrong thing?
The commonest thing I would say that's a problem is people just are impressed by the child's verbal ability. There's a radio station in New York that's always broadcasting ads for some kind of verbal learning program. It basically teaches you vocabulary. And the joke I always tell parents is it's kind of like, you know, the ad goes, speak like a Harvard graduate, as if anybody would like to speak like a Harvard graduate. I can say that as a Yale person. But the point is that we make our judgments about people's intelligence based on their verbal ability. And these are kids who are very verbal. And the problem is that the teacher will assume, because of the child's very good verbal ability, that all their other skills are at that level. And the reality is they're making a very bad judgment. I just literally this week saw an eight-year-old boy, okay, in terms of his chronological age. His verbal abilities were at the 12-year level. His nonverbal problem solving was a little below his age level, so he's already got a 4-year gap there. And his social skills were at about a 2.5-year level. So, you know, if you just go by his verbal, you'll think, oh, he's like a 10-year-old. He's very bright. And, in fact, he's in some gifted classes. But the problem is if you look at other skills, and verbal skills are not the only ones we need in school. We need nonverbal ones as well. In fact, he's a little behind his age level. If you look at his social, he's dreadfully behind where he should be. So which is the real boy? Well, they're all the real boy. It's just different aspects. But it's very common for people to be misled by the better verbal abilities. The saddest thing, and the thing that unfortunately we see a lot, is the child's verbal ability means that the teacher assumes that he's a bad boy because he talks back. Asperger himself wrote about this. The child talks back because that's what the child's strength is. That's what they can do is talk back. That's all the child knows. As a result of talking back, the school will decide, well, bad boy. And they'll put him in a class for really bad boys. But the other bad boys in the class are really bad boys, and they're very socially clued in. So that then what will happen is they will set this child up, who's very socially clueless, to do all kinds of things. So you have the perfect victim put in the class with the perfect victimizers.
What do you think is the right place for a child like the hypothetical child that you're describing, who is very verbal but isn't up to speed in terms of social skills or other skills?
Many times children can be supported in regular academic settings if the school is committed to doing it. What you then need is to make provision for helping the child with areas that are going to cause trouble. So there has to be, for example, teaching of social skills. Often these are children who have handwriting problems. They have so-called graphomotor difficulties because they have motor issues. So you have to cope with that. There may be some very specific learning difficulties that are present. And finally, you have to be aware that the situations that are going to cause the child the most trouble are the situations that the school will usually think of as last on their list of situations that will cause the child trouble. So, for example, there's almost a holy trinity of mainstreaming opportunities for gym, recess, and cafeteria. That's the places where almost inevitably children with Asperger's are mainstreamed, and those are the three worst places to mainstream a child with Asperger's.
Why?
In the recess, for example, I not very long ago had a teacher, a very observant teacher, who had gone out at recess time, and she had seen this boy in her third grade class who was sitting in the corner of the schoolyard breaking rocks against each other. And he did this for several days in a row. And that's how he spent the whole of the recess. And so she called the mother, and the mother called me, and I got back to them, and I made the great observation, why don't you ask him why he's doing this? And so the teacher did, and he said, you know, Mrs. Smith, I've learned that if I stay in this corner at recess and just knock these rocks together, I don't get into any trouble. And, you know, she realized that having him out at recess by himself with no support was not such a good move. He'd really come up with this as his adaptation, as a way of avoiding mixing it up with other kids because he had so much difficulty without the support of an adult.
Oh, I'm just thinking about how painful it must be for a child like that to be thrown into, you know, the gym class or cafeteria or recess. That's all
Absolutely.
About like social skills and physical skills, which they don't have. You know, since children with Asperger's syndrome don't usually feel empathy as we understand it for other people, what about their own sense of pain when they're hurt? Is that any different?
You sometimes will see children where the parents will say things like the child doesn't complain much when they're in pain. Most of the time there is some basic awareness. It is a problem, though. I mean, I would say that it comes up more commonly around such feelings like, for example, anxiety or depression. Anxiety is a common one in the sense of the child may not really quite understand what it feels like to be anxious. I mean, they'll be anxious, but they have trouble putting the word to it because they don't know what the experience is like. And again, I would argue that because of the social difficulties, because of the difficulty relating to other people and observing other people, as a result, they themselves have trouble in terms of their own sense of themselves, their own sense of their body, their own sense of themselves in space, their own kind of organization in terms of their feelings. So sometimes I've actually spent time helping a child become more aware of their feelings, talking about, for example, how do I know that I'm anxious? What does my body feel like? My heart is pounding, my skin is sweating, I feel like I'm breathing very fast. Oh, I must be anxious. That they can really work backward from those experiences of their body to the feeling.
Now, more boys than girls have Asperger's syndrome. What I find interesting about that is if I were to just use like stereotypes of male and female behavior, the typical patterns of autism are in some ways highly exaggerated versions of stereotypical male behavior. Not as much empathy as girls have. Maybe very verbal, but maybe a little self-absorbed in the conversation. Prone to obsession about facts. I know I'm being unfair here, as all stereotypes are, but still they tend to be more male than female behaviors. You know where to email me if that makes you angry. But anyways, what do you make of the fact that there's more males than females with Asperger's syndrome, and does it have any connection to larger patterns of behavior?
It's a very good question, and one that's really needs a lot more research and study. That being said, it's clear that basically for almost all of the developmental disorders, with some notable exceptions, that are always very interesting. But for almost all the disorders, for example, language disorders, attentional problems, there's a male predominance early in life. And it probably is because males as a group are somewhat more vulnerable than females. For autism, for example, we know that males outnumber females 4 to 5 to 1. Interestingly, when a girl has autism, often she's more severely affected, which kind of makes us think, one guess is, that perhaps it takes more of whatever it is to cause the autism in the girl. So that there are a lot of interesting tantalizing leads. There's not a tremendous amount of information in terms of mechanisms. It's a very interesting question. There's some growing body of work looking at brain differences in terms of things like processing social information, processing feelings. That may help us understand more about what it's like.
Dr. Fred Volkmar is a professor at the Yale Child Study Center. His latest book is Healthcare for Children on the Autism Spectrum. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, now featuring My Soul Looks Back in Wonder, Voices of the Civil Rights Experience by Juan Williams, available at Barnes & Noble stores and at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the Sundance Channel, Film Starts Here, presenting the TV premiere of In This World from director Michael Winterbottom, tonight at 9. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on Asperger's syndrome with Dr. Fred Volkmar, and we'll talk to Michael John Carley, who was diagnosed with the disorder when he was in his mid-30s. It helped explain a lot about his life. His son has Asperger's, too. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. Fred Volkmar. He heads autism research at Yale University and is a professor at the Yale Child Study Center. He's an expert on Asperger syndrome, a developmental disorder. Children and adults with Asperger's are typically very verbal but have difficulty communicating. They're usually physically awkward and become obsessed with one subject or area of knowledge. At what age is Asperger syndrome usually diagnosed? Like, when can you actually start to recognize the symptoms?
The youngest child I think I've seen was probably a little over 3 years of age. More typically, it's 5 and 6 year olds.
And what starts to be noticeable at that age?
Usually the problem is problems with peer interaction. The parents have been very reassured because the child is so verbal, and adults make a lot of allowances for little children. It's when the child is exposed to other peers, typically in preschool or kindergarten, that the pedal hits the metal. And the problem there is the child is very inappropriate socially, will come up to a total strange child, another boy, and hug him. And that turns out not to endear you to other four-year-old boys who are typically developing. They won't be able to sit in circle time. They won't have any idea that the rules apply to them. So that it's that kind of thing that often brings the child to first attention.
And then once you get to that point, then the question is, but is there action you should take to try to bring your child more into the mainstream and teach them more mainstream behavior?
Absolutely. And again, you want to be guided, I think, by a sensible appreciation of what this child's strengths and weaknesses are. I think that's one of the things that's very important. It's easy to notice the strengths in terms of the good verbal abilities. Often we don't appreciate these are children who have real significant learning challenges in other areas. Nonverbal tasks can be very difficult. Things that involve a motor aspect, fine motor skills, handwriting can be very difficult. Gross motor activities, play, for example. I've had parents whose idea of teaching their child social skills, a child with Asperger's, is to try to enroll them in, you know, youth football or youth baseball. The problem is you're then going to multiple weaknesses of the child because these are team sports. They're very, very, very social, and also there's a tremendous motor aspect, so that you're just setting the child up to fail. So that, again, if you were going to be guided, I think, by the child's strengths and weaknesses, you would try to find a sport more like swimming or taekwondo. Even tennis is a little better in the sense of at least it's dyadic. So that, again, the kinds of things that people try to do really ought to be guided by an appreciation of what the child's strengths are as well as their weaknesses.
What are some of the typical mistakes that are made in diagnosing children who actually have Asperger syndrome?
Well, many of the things that we do in terms of our ordinary work with children work just fine. On the other hand, I think one of the mistakes sometimes is people don't pay as much attention either to the reality of what the child says, or conversely, they sort of miss the forest for the trees. For example, I can think of one of the psychology people I work with, who's a wonderful girl in training, wonderful woman in training, and she's just a marvelous person, and she's just learning. And so one girl I saw with Asperger's was being tested by this psychology trainee. And in the course of the testing, the girl with Asperger's was shown a picture of, I think it was an upside-down triangle or some such. And the girl, and I'm watching this from behind a one-way mirror, and the psychologist is doing the testing, and the girl says, "Oh, look, it's a Ventnor." And the psychologist says, "Okay," but then she writes down Ventnor, but she wants the girl to do the whatever it is, the little block task, and so she moves right along. And so then when she came back to talk to me, I said, "Go back in and ask the girl what a Ventnor is." And so the girl explains, "Do you know what a Ventnor is?"
You asking me?
Do you know what a Ventnor is? Exactly. Neither did I. That's why you ask, right? And that's what she should have asked. So the girl explains it's a cow, and she pulls out her book of cows. It's a cow that on its flank on both sides has an upside-down triangle. And so the psychologist wouldn't have known, because the girl was being very, you know, polite. She was not going off into her special interest. It sort of slipped in a little bit there. I've also seen people try to do kind of typical things in terms of assessment. So, for example, the child seems a little loquacious. They seem a little pressured in terms of their speech. You wonder how much they're in touch with reality. And so sometimes people will do things like they'll get out the ink blots, the Rorschach cards.
Mm-hmm.
It's meant to be a very unstructured thing, and people, you look there and you see bats or giants or whatever. And basically the fundamental notion is if you're a little crazy, you'll say crazy things because that's what you see in it. And so this one situation, we had a girl And the trainee was, again, very interested in the girl, decided because the girl was so loquacious that she would get out her Rorschach cards. It turns out this girl's thing was protozoans. And so guess what she saw on every single Rorschach card?
Protozoa.
You got it.
Right.
She got it. She saw an amoeba. She saw a paramecium. And I said to the psychologist, of course, that's what she's going to see. You know, that's her thing. You know, what do you expect? So it's things like that that sometimes people make mistakes. The other big mistake, as I say, is to have people ignore the fact that the child has real learning disabilities because they're so off-put by the child's great verbal skills, they don't pay enough attention to the difficulties in the nonverbal area.
When you know that a child has the syndrome and you can see that they have a special interest, even if that interest strikes you as weird, eccentric, and unimportant and uninteresting, should you still, do you think, encourage it?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting question, and indeed, Asperger himself speculated that some of these children, as adults, would be able to follow their special interest, and to some extent that happens. I would say as a practical matter, often the special interest comes to dominate the family's life, and there often needs to be some attempt to control it. Control it in the sense of either localize it in time or space, but to have it so that it does not dominate to the extent that the child is really excluded from other opportunities. There can be real challenges sometimes, depending on the nature of the special interest, how you can get it into the classroom and the curriculum. One of my favorite stories, a few years ago, there was a young man who now is a young adult who I first knew probably when he was, seven or eight, and his thing is snakes. It's always been snakes and probably always will be snakes. And he had met one of my colleagues who was a speech pathologist from England, and he talked to her about the dreaded puff adder. Then he met my colleague Ami Klin, who's from Brazil, and he talked to Ami about the giant anaconda of Brazil. And then when I came in, the first thing he said was, well, thank God at last an American. And then the second thing he said was he wanted to talk to me about the endangered pygmy rattlesnake of upstate Connecticut. And so this kid's snakes has always been his thing. So in my state, and I think it's the sixth or seventh grade, all of a sudden there's a unit on American history. And his school, which was a wonderful school, a very well-motivated school, it worked very well with him, they're coming up to this unit on American history, the highlight of which is the Battle of Gettysburg. Now, the problem is this child had absolutely zero, zilch, nada interest in the Battle of Gettysburg. I mean, really none. And so the teacher and the mother called me, and we had a little phone conversation about what in the world they were going to do, because this was the highlight of the teacher's year. This was it. She was going to teach the children about learning, about research skills, about reading maps, about American history, and it was all going to come together. There were going to be school presentations. It was a big deal. And so we talked for a while, and I had this one of my occasional inspired great moments of thinking and said, gosh, I bet there were snakes at the Battle of Gettysburg. And the teacher said, oh my gosh, I'd never thought of that. So the boy's project was the snakes of the Battle of Gettysburg. His whole thing was, because you know, it turns out Robert E. Lee is down by the creek and he's going to see the dreaded water moccasin. Meade is on top of the cemetery ridge or wherever it was, and he's going to see the common garter snake. And then we've got Pickett's Charge, and what are they going to see? He's charging up through the cornfield. And so he had to learn about maps. He had to learn a fair amount about the various people and where their locations were and where they were moving. And the principal actually called me afterwards to say, you know, this is all the only time in all these years when this kid has been so interested in snakes that it was even semi-functional. And he actually got to present his thing for the whole school, because people had heard about snakes over the years. They were sick of hearing about the snakes, but this was close enough, and they enjoyed it. So that if you can find some way to tie it in, to make it functional, it's not always as easy as I might make it sound, unfortunately. But when you can do it, it's a great thing.
We've been talking about children with Asperger syndrome, and after all, you are a child psychiatrist. But I'm wondering if you've worked at all with adults, and if any of the issues associated with the syndrome in childhood can be overcome as adults.
A very good question. Interestingly enough, it turns out in this country, to be a child psychiatrist, you have to be an adult psychiatrist first. So that only makes it a little harder to become a child psychiatrist. So in fact, I've seen a lot of adults.
Uh-huh.
Sadly, I think one of the things, many adults, of course, were missed because the awareness of Asperger's was quite limited. So there's a whole host of adults out there with Asperger's who were not picked up and diagnosed and who did not get services and who may, for example, not even now realize that this is what's wrong with them. They sometimes have persistent difficulties in terms of feeling depressed. Many of them, however, marry and go on to have very productive lives. So there seems to be a range of outcomes. There increasingly are more and more books and other resources out there for people who are adults. There's some now some organized chat rooms and parent support organizations online. So there are more and more things out there, but unfortunately, it's a relatively recent phenomenon in terms of adult recognition of Asperger's. Sadly, in our country, we have not done a great job of providing for the special needs of higher functioning people with social disabilities. This is true for people with autism as well. In most states, the way you qualify for special services as an adult is if you happen to be mentally handicapped or mentally retarded. If you're somebody with Asperger's who's got an IQ in the normal range, even if you're quite disabled, you usually don't qualify for the usual kinds of services.
I know some people who have some of the symptoms of Asperger syndrome, but they don't have it to the extreme that I think people who actually have the syndrome do. But they have that kind of constellation of issues. Is it possible to have like a mild case of Asperger syndrome, a touch of Asperger syndrome?
Well, you know, I think one of the things, in some ways it's easier to talk about this with autism where we have even more of a research track record, but I think the same thing will be true in Asperger's syndrome. In a funny, somewhat paradoxical way, as we've gotten better and better and better in terms of thinking about what we really mean by autism, very strict, hardcore definitions of autism, in a funny way, we're also now much more aware of the broader range of children who have some of those difficulties, but not all of them. I think as we find genes, which likely will happen over the next couple of years for both autism and Asperger's syndrome, this will all make much more sense. We may, for example, discover that there are, let's say, five or six genes that cause autism. You have to have all five or six. Let's say if you have two or three of those genes, maybe you have some little oddity or quirkiness. As we get into it with actual genes and can relate the genes to things in the brain, we'll be able to do a much better job of understanding this. There's no question it's a very interesting area right now for research.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Dr. Fred Volkmar is a professor at the Yale Child Study Center. His latest book is a guide for parents called Healthcare for Children on the Autism Spectrum. Coming up, we talk with Michael John Carley, who was diagnosed with Asperger syndrome 4 years ago after his son was diagnosed. This is Fresh Air. We've been talking about Asperger syndrome, a developmental disorder that was only recently recognized. My guest, Michael John Carley, was diagnosed with Asperger's 4 years ago when he was in his mid-30s. It helped explain a lot about his life. Now he heads an education and support group for people with Asperger's called GRASP. He's worked as the UN representative of the group Veterans for Peace and directed the group's Iraq Water Project. He's also written several plays and is a part-time overnight classical music announcer on the public radio station WNYC in New York. Michael, how were you first diagnosed with Asperger syndrome?
Well, my son, when he was 2 years old, started to exhibit a lot of the usual telltale signs, language issues. There were some motor skills issues. And so my wife at the time and I, you know, started him on that battery of tests and process towards the diagnosis, which includes hearing tests, IT, it includes speech therapy, play therapy. And 2 years later, he was diagnosed with Asperger syndrome, and exactly 1 week later, I was diagnosed with it. And the reason for this is really just that once they start to key in on the kids, it's a genetic thing. I think most everybody agrees. And so inevitably, you know, the clinicians that are responsible for this diagnosis are starting to look at dad out of the corner of their eyes. And so one thing leads to another.
Were you surprised to be diagnosed yourself?
Initially, when the idea first came forth, yes, the whole suggestion of it just seemed, you know, too ridiculous. You know, we regard this as a form of autism. And here I was, somebody that had done things, had lived a life, etc. But I also had known that I'd always suspected that, you know, I really didn't have that sense of shared experience with other people that I had wanted and yearned for in my life. And the more I started to look into it, the more it made absolute sense in a real epiphanal, you know, sort of way. I mean, really hitting you like a ton of bricks. And so by the time that the official diagnosis came about, it was really etched in stone that this was obviously what had been going on my entire life.
What were some of the things that the diagnosis helped explain to you about yourself?
Well, really just, you know, it's the whole notion of personality comes in later. I think first off, what you go through when you get a diagnosis so late in life is that you have to reexamine so many incidents in your history. You know, you have to reevaluate and look at everything and say, so that's why people thought that I was being a jerk. And that's why people thought that I was being a tell it like it is guy. You know, you're always surrounded by this negative and this positive iconography. But you also know now they were all wrong, both the positives and the negatives. Nobody had you pegged right.
What was most confusing to you about, quote, normal behavior and quote, normal conversations and social skills?
Small talk, especially. I never was very good at small talk. I never understood it. I never understood that when people would ask me about something that I was interested in and I would, you know, completely go off because I was, you know, so in love with this particular, you know, study or item or something like that. And then people would roll their eyes and I would feel, it's not fair. You asked me what I felt about this. Why are you rolling your eyes sarcastically? Pettiness, I think, is something that is very anathema to all of the people in our community. It's just something that we don't understand, and that in the support groups that my organization runs, we really try to point out to individuals on the spectrum what pettiness is, because really when you deconstruct it, it's something that we instinctively do not understand. And it's something that we need to understand, because not only is it something that, you know, is a stumbling block for us, but it's an unfriendly creature. And we need to know how to navigate around it and not to take it too personally.
Now, you've written plays, some of which have been produced. Writing plays seems to go against some of the typical Asperger's syndrome symptoms, as I understand them, lacking in empathy, talking obsessively about your passion but not being very interested in what others have to say, not understanding the pleasures of conversation, not comprehending humor. When you're a playwright, you're writing conversation. Hopefully there's some humor in it, and hopefully you have empathy with your characters. So how do those square?
That's an excellent question. And there's an answer for it. And that is that really one thing that is enormously helpful to all individuals on the spectrum, we see about, you know, we have about 400 people in the Manhattan support group. I'm actually not digressing, trust me. And so many of them that have had more success in being able to process what other people's feelings are have had a theater background. They may not have succeeded in that theater background, but it's a real leitmotif, I think, especially the actor training that anybody has to go through, to learning how to be in somebody else's shoes. And there's another side to the theater training that's another dodged bullet, even though at the time I didn't know I was dodging bullets, and that's the physical training that you go through, because a lot of us have motor skills issues, and I had real issues with my hands and controlling my hands, and the physical discipline that you have to, you know, accrue as an actor really, really helps to compensate for some of those motor skills issues. Even if, you know, the actor next to you is doing 10 times better with his hand control than you are, and you're getting mad about it at the time.
But if you don't really like small talk and conversation, and empathy isn't your thing, why would you gravitate to writing plays in the first place?
Well, I think no matter what, you know, I always grew up as, you know, somebody who, you know, selfishly perhaps, you know, felt that, you know, I had something to say. But the empathy quotient, I think, is more best answered by seeing my plays. They're really ideas, and they're arguments of ideas that get thrown around. You know, I was never a good student of philosophy. I would just, you know, pick up a philosophy book and, you know, read a sentence or two and be able to, you know, just grab just one idea, and then really be able to put, you know, some dramatized discourse of it down on paper. And I think that in my plays, what I would do to compensate for the Aspergian sense, I could pick up and give, you know, class distinctions or economic distinctions or racial distinctions and the dialogue and the vernacular that people hear, because I had a very good ear. But I think when it comes time to really people speaking from inside their souls, you know, that I actually just didn't do that. I actually just put certain ideas and certain arguments into certain characters and very mathematically matched them up with that particular economic or racial, characteristic, and just let the math do its work.
Now, you worked with the group Veterans for Peace. Are you a veteran?
No, I am not. I was, as a matter of fact, one of the few non-veterans that worked with the group. My loophole into them was that my father was killed in Vietnam, and this actually has some of the reason why so much of my, Aspergian tendencies growing up were so misinterpreted, because, I grew up amidst the iconography of the Vietnam War. I had people from the left telling me my father was a murderer. I had people from the right telling me things about patriotism and God, which, I just didn't really get and didn't really understand and didn't really believe in, although I respected their beliefs. And so inevitably, I really had to, I think, and this is hard to say, but really tune off those adults in my life. But at the same point, acknowledge that all of my behavioral differences when I was going to the school I was going to up until ninth grade, which was not a good institution for me to be at, that they were being interpreted as some sort of rebellion because of my having lost my father in the Vietnam War. And it was a very easy answer. As a matter of fact, I was going through, huge school difficulties in third grade, and the school finally said to my mother, look, you have to get this kid a psychological evaluation. And I have that psychological evaluation, and I use it in some of the speeches that I give at conferences, because it's very fascinating in the sense that when they document my behaviors and when they look at exactly some of the things that I'm doing in their tests, they're actually quite accurate. And, anybody looking at this today would say, Asperger's, easy.
My guest is Michael John Carley. He heads an education and support group for people with Asperger syndrome called GRASP. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael John Carley. He and his son were diagnosed with the developmental disorder Asperger syndrome 4 years ago. What are some of the ways that you think Asperger syndrome may have interfered, if at all, with relationships, with intimate relationships in your life?
Well, it always made me bad at flirting, and it always meant that, I was never going to be a good dancer or anything like that. One of the things we tell all the folks that we have, is avoid the bars. Please avoid the bars. Please don't try and pretend to be like the people who wink in beer commercials. Please don't do that. You'll fall on your face. There's an inevitable banana peel somewhere in your crystal ball. But I think that, one of the things that doesn't really get talked about sometimes is that there are actually some attributes that don't get developed enough, such as, we're known for being an inordinately honest people. Sometimes, obviously, to a fault, we say what comes into our heads, and sometimes it's very inappropriate. But this can be compensated by education, and for the most part, a lot of the relationships that I did have were based on people looking at me, seeing, a certain amount of, passion that I was putting into whatever work that I was putting into, admiring me because of that and not because I wore the right clothes, and, in conversing with me, realizing that I wasn't going to be somebody who could, quote-unquote, play the game. And that's attractive to a lot of people. And it unfortunately doesn't get developed enough in the adults that we have.
Now, your son has Asperger's syndrome. Did you recognize any similarities, or do you recognize any similarities between his behavior and yours?
A plethora. He's a twin in so many ways, behaviorally and in the way in which he's processing thought, processing experience, and it's a joy to raise him, because I know that, you know, there's a good and a bad to being diagnosed late. And the bad is obviously that you would have known yourself a lot better early on, I think. But the good is that you avoided so much negative iconography. You know, people weren't prepared to deal with this. And if anybody had used, you know, Asperger's syndrome or autism as a word to describe me way back then in the early 70s when I'm, you know, Will's age, then, you know, suddenly that would be a horrific future for me, just because of the times we lived in. What my son is going through right now is vastly different. He's accepted for those behavioral differences. People know what's going on with him.
Do you think that there are certain things that parents typically want from their children, or like emotions they want their children to give back, that children with Asperger's syndrome are unable or less likely to do?
Yes. The best example comes from Tony Atwood's book, where there was a mother who was finally had to break down crying to her 8-year-old child. Why do you never, ever tell me that you love me? Why? And the child just looked at her perplexed and said, "Mom, I told you that when I was 6.
Mm-hmm. So as we've established the fact, there's no point to reiterate it.
No, exactly. Well, the child with Asperger's syndrome is like, "Well, but I already told you that. Why do you need to hear it again?" The whole notion of the need for affirmative reinforcement is something that is not instinctive to us. We don't understand it. We can learn it very easily. But at that age, I can purely, you know, see that child's point of view.
Well, Michael John Carley, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you. It has been my pleasure.
Michael John Carley is the executive director of GRASP, an education and support group for people with Asperger's syndrome. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Warner Home Video, presenting The Last Samurai on DVD. Tom Cruise stars as a soldier who joins a band of samurai warriors to save the heart of Japan. And from HBO Films, presenting the DVD release of Elephant, written and directed by Gus Van Sant. It's a single ordinary day, except it's not. Available wherever DVDs and videos are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Our transportation, our economy, and some say our wars revolve around oil. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Paul Roberts, author of The End of Oil, about how the depletion of global oil reserves is affecting politics, the military, industry, and the environment. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.